Good morning, and first we would like to thank the organizers, in particular André Bandrock, for inviting us, and we have already enjoyed 1 week, and we have seen it's very interdisciplinary and we could learn a lot, and there are so many fields which come together under this topic, and it's a great experience for us. We also think it's a little paradise here in Santa Barbara, where you can study the wave packet dynamics in real nature, and also how you can go over barriers and from one minimum to another one. So it's wonderful surrounding here. Very grateful to be here. This is my PhD student, Ingo Barth. He is handicapped, therefore he cannot speak and cannot listen from his birth, but I will speak for him. And Dr. Gnotke has kindly volunteered to write the questions, if you have any questions, and Ingo could eventually provide some answers. That's how we communicate. I would like to say that all the PowerPoint presentation and all the science, Ingo did himself, and also the science we discussed together, and it's really, I could not do anything without Ingo, and I think it's vice versa, so it's really a tandem presentation, but I'm the person who can speak. Okay. So, I was asked to read the title because it is misleading. So it's Quantum Simulations of Effects of Hue Cycle Attosecond to Near Femtosecond Laser Pulses on Valence Electrons. And the examples are ring currents, electron circulations, and ionization. And from the beginning, I want to acknowledge our co-authors. So the talk will be on three applications. The magnesium porphyrin was done in cooperation with two co-workers from Tokyo University. The aluminium chloride is done in cooperation with Caroline Nasser from Free University, and also with Luis Serrano Andres from Valencia, and also with Tamar Seidemann from Evanston. And finally, the parts for hydrogen are done together with Leticia Gonzalez from our university and with Gennady Paramonov, who is a frequent visitor at our place from Minsk. Motivation, well, 5 years ago, attoseconds appeared, and this is a new field, and we were very fascinated. And of course, all of you know these pioneering works. Then there are a few theory groups who immediately enter this field, and we admire really the work of André Bandrock and his group. Very glad to learn Dr. Tchaikovsky for the first time. I knew your name from the literature. But there are, of course, also other very strong groups. I take this as an example, and this is a recent review which is appearing very soon, and which is also guiding our work. So we are late comers in this field. We started only 2 years ago. For our applications, which are on molecules, we make the following assumptions. We assume that on this very short time of attoseconds or few femtoseconds, the nuclei are fixed. Also, the orientation is fixed, and there are various methods how to do this. For example, the method designed by Tamar Seidemann. Then we assume that we always start from an electronic eigenstate. This can be the ground state or an excited state. And we assume that on this ultra-short timescale, effects of spin orbit coupling or spin conservation are negligible. Again, here are the three applications, magnesium porphyrin, aluminum chloride, and hydrogen. And for the first two, we will show that you can use short laser pulses to induce electronic ring currents or electron circulation. this will be shown for two cases. And in this case, the method is simply expansion in terms of electronic eigenstates. I will come to the details a little later. And for hydrogen, we are interested in simulations of ionization. We will do this in an explicit single active electron model as a reference for better models and methods. Now we come to our first system, magnesium porphyrin. This was chosen because of its role. For example, this molecule is used in photodynamic therapy in medicine. It's very important and it has very nice properties. In particular, it has symmetry, D4H symmetry, as you can see. And this is a key to the phenomena which will be derived later. So for this system, we choose to design laser pulses which will excite specific electronic eigenstates with degenerate symmetry. So we choose the E symmetry. This is doubly degenerate, and from these doubly degenerate states you can form a complex eigenstate which corresponds to electron circulation or electron ring currents. And we want to induce either one state selectively or another state, or we will also excite superposition states, and you will see this will correspond to electron circulation and ionization. And here's just a list of the electronic eigenstates with this given symmetry. Of course, there are many other states. In principle, this is quite dense. But as you can see, the distance between these states is of the order of 1 electron volts. And that allows us to discriminate the excitation of these states even using very short laser pulses. So we have no problems with the uncertainty relationship for these pulses exciting these eigenstates. So here's the time-dependent Schrödinger equation that we apply for our simulations, and we will expand the solution in terms of electronic eigenstates as long as we do not go to the continuum, so as long as we do not have ionization. And that means our solution is written very simply as such, and there are many methods in the world, or not so many, but there are a few methods, for example the one by Scrinzi and by Saalfrank and few others who developed techniques to describe the time evolution of laser-driven electrons in such systems. And there are many different methods, but we think this is rather simple in this domain of bound-to-bound state transitions, because you can use all the properties that you have from quantum chemistry. So you just take any quantum chemistry program which is adequate, and then you design the electronic states, and you get the electronic eigenenergies and eigenstates. You calculate the dipole, transition dipoles. That's all you need. And with this input, you just have to propagate this. So what you do is you insert this ansatz into the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, then you get a set of coupled equations for these coefficients, and they can be solved using standard techniques. And this is how we got the solutions.
So you're only expanding in bound state eigenfunctions?
Yeah, for these systems, as long as you are in the domain of bound state to bound state transitions, as long as ionization doesn't play a role. I will talk about ionization later. Then, of course, this cannot be applied, but as long as you are relatively down in energy, this means maybe 10 eV or so below this, then this is applicable.
How many terms typically you have in this sum?
Well, we have to differentiate. For the given symmetry, it is about 20. But for this cause, because the others are forbidden by selection rules, but this corresponds to hundreds of states if you would include all other states. So in this domain there are many, many states, but many of them are decoupled. So we just choose a selection of symmetry selected states which can be excited. The others are switched off. So it's not too many.
When you say about the infinity, but whether the comparison of oscillating energy, some oscillating energy with some other energies of
yes, so I will come to this later when I come to the real applications, you will see the numbers. But the intensities are in our application, in the first application when we are not going to ionization is typically below 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeters. So it's below the, we make sure that we are below the Keldysh limit and that we have no ionization. So in this respect it is almost in the linear regime. Okay. So the method is very simple. And here's our model for the circularly polarized laser pulse. For example, we assume it's propagating along the z direction. Then we have two components, and the corresponding intensity is just the square of this. And this is then going with the shape of the laser pulse. In the first applications, later I'll show others, we will use the famous sine squared type of pulses, which, by the way, were introduced by Paramonov in 1983. Hardly ever quoted, but it's very useful and used by many people. And the corresponding pulse duration is given here in terms of the total duration of this laser pulse. And then we have to observe the energy-time uncertainty relationship for this specific shape of the laser pulse. And for example, this means if we apply a laser pulse which has few femtoseconds, say 3 femtoseconds, then the width of this pulse is 0.6 eV. And if you remember the table before, the width of this pulse is then smaller than the energy spacing of the states which we want to excite selectively. For this purpose, these pulses are useful. Now, just for a reference, we consider a model where we excite really state selectively only a single state. So this would assume that we apply pulses which are of the order of 10 femtoseconds. But please, this is only for a reference. Later we will really go to shorter pulses. And in this situation, the ansatz of an expansion in many eigenstates can be broken down to just 3 states, for example, the ground state, and then the 2 degenerate states which describe the ring currents. And so everything in this very simple approximation breaks down to a 3-state system. And we can apply the, for the resonance condition, we can apply the random wave approximation, and then it is well known that this has a closed form solution and which we can use as a guidance for searching for the pulses which will do the job that we want to do. So these are closed form solutions, very well known, and for example we can design a so-called pipe pulse in this 3-state model. And this means that the parameters of the transition dipole are given, of course, for the system. And then we can choose either the length of the laser pulse or the intensity or the amplitude of the laser field such that we get pi here. And if we apply these pulses, then the ground state will disappear at the expense of or to the benefit of the target state. And this will be one application. In another application, we will request that we have not pi, but pi half as a reference. And then we will excite a 50-50% superposition of the 2 states. And then, of course, we do not prepare an eigenstate, but rather a superposition state, which will be time dependent. And this one will describe electron ring currents, whereas this one will describe electron circulation. So here we, at the end of the pulse, we prepare a stationary state, an eigenstate, whereas here we excite a superposition state, in chemistry also called a hybrid state, which is periodic, and the periodicity is of course due to the energy difference of the excited state and the ground state. Now I want to show a movie, a model simulation of the phenomenon. So what will happen if such a pulse is shining on this planar molecule? And of course this circularly polarized pulse contains a helicity, and we will show that this helicity is transferred to the helicity of the molecule, namely to the helicity of the electrons, and this will be shown by a movie. Okay, so what this movie will show is first of all the circularly polarized laser pulse in the XY component. This is the X component and this is the Y component. And here you see the clock, so this is now a time, a laser pulse which has about 3 femtoseconds duration. The total duration is about 10 femtoseconds. And that's the laser pulse, and on the same time you see what happens with the electrons. And I will repeat the film once more, but what you see here is the difference of the electron density at time t minus the initial density. So initially you don't see anything, and then the laser pulse will start to work, and then it creates an electron difference. And at some domains you have more electrons at the expense of less electron density at other positions. And the red is, it's not as in traffic. Red here means more, and green means less. Okay. So.
Can I ask something?
Please, yes, sure.
If I understand you correctly, you had this 3x3 system.
No, this was only as a reference.
Why?
So for this, we really apply the full set. But the reference is used as the initial to choose the parameters of the laser pulses, which will then be re-optimized to get it for the full set.
So in this you had more states then?
Yes, yes, yes.
How many?
Of the order of 20.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, many people here know about pi pulses, and so this was just a reference, and that's how we start the optimization. So we start from this two-state or three-state model, we choose the parameters, and then we get, for example, say 80% selectivity, not 100. And then we retune the parameters starting from this reference, such that we get close to 100% population transfer.
So by choosing the parameters that optimize the 3x3 system
as a start,
you apply them to the,
yes,
to the 20 states.
Yes,
and it,
right, and it works already for 80%, and then from this we start to re-optimize the parameters, mm-hmm, and to get better efficiency. And because for 20 states we do not have a closed form solution, so we start from this reference, and then we do this by hand, so we let the computer search for better parameters. For example, we keep the total duration fixed, but we vary systematically the pulse intensity or the pulse, also the frequency, we retune. It is not really on resonance for the best solution, it's close to it. So we optimize the parameters.
And the 20 state, and then it's,
yeah,
within the rotating wave of change?
No, it's without. So it's a complete set of...
I see. So then are you saying that the counter-rotating wave of approximation, the counter-rotating,
yes,
wave,
yes,
plays an important role in the 20 states?
No, we checked that, and it doesn't play an important role. Only if you go to extremely short pulses, then you see the effects. So if we have pulses which are, say, it depends on the transition frequency, but if the pulses are getting, say, at close to 500 attoseconds, then we we see some
effect. The counter-rotating, I would expect to play a role if you had your extremely short pulses where the beams have no meaning, and also in high intensity.
Yes.
But your intensity is low, you are saying. So
they are low enough, yes. Okay. There you are.
So actually your initial guess based on these three level model was quite good.
It was already quite good. It did already a very good job.
Intensity, and by how much did you change the intensity to get 100?
Maybe by 20% plus or minus, and also the frequency. The frequency is more sensitive actually. So we also detune the frequency slightly, and there are different ways of getting. It's not a unique solution. So usually we try to keep the intensity low, so it's easy to blow it up on the computer. But then in reality, we know ionization would happen.
It's almost like a miracle to me. It's almost like a miracle from the three state.
Yeah. I mean, actually, the three-state model is a good reference already. And if you include, we will later see a comparison of a three-state application and a full, and I show this later.
But if you had, if you needed 50 states or 60 states, would it still work? I mean, is that?
It depends on the laser parameters. There was a very good application. Investigation of this by the group of Peter Saalfrank and Tilman Klamroth, published last year and this year. They are investigating this, and there are specific cases where you have where the three-state or two-state model for linear polarized pulses wouldn't be a good job at all. But there are other domains, in particular if you have long pulses or less intense pulses, where a two-state model can be quite well. It depends on the system, on the transition dipoles, on the magnitudes, etc. So one cannot give a general rule for all the molecules. So for
why do you need this initial guess at all?
It's not necessary. No, it's yes. Why not? Yeah, we could do this, but this is useful to rationalize the order of magnitude of this pulse parameters. So they are always close in our applications. Yes. Yes, the frequency is quite important, so this is very sensitive, whereas the laser intensity is less sensitive. So you can vary the laser intensity within, say, 20% and you still get 80% efficiency. Whereas the frequency you can vary within, say, 2% and then you are out. So this is very.
And in your calculation, just one photon transition? Or the many photon transitions?
Well, if you have a pi pulse, you don't know. I mean, this can be up and up, down, up, and up, down. There can be many such. But what is very important is that at the end, a netto one photon is transferred. For example, the angular momentum which is transferred is h bar. It's a photon, only one, and not 1.5 or so. We think so. If we see the time evolution of the population, we see small wiggles, and this we interpret as a consequence of up down of intrapulse pump dump processes, but we did not analyze this, so it is only a our interpretation. Yes. Okay. So here you see the circularly polarized pulse, and now you can see we start from nothing, and now the pulse induces shifts of the electron density to positive and to negative, and now you can see that this is if you follow one of these, there's an interesting mechanism. So on the way to the preparation of the ionization, we can already see that there is that the electrons are driven, but the laser pulse is designed such that at the very end we prepare an eigenstate electronic eigenstate, and therefore at the very end you don't see anything more. But that is only the density. If you look for the current, then you see there's a lot of things going on here. In other words, what is coming in from the left, say, is leaving on the right, and this is continuous. So other, in other words, these states correspond to a ring current. And now this is the ring current with ring current densities shown here, and the arrows just point to the dominant fluxes, which is induced by the short laser pulse on the one hand, and on the other hand, this is a comparison with the corresponding ring current, which is induced by the traditional technique. Usually people put a molecule into a magnetic field, and then they also induce a ring current. And on first glance, this looks very similar, but if you look closely, there are huge differences. Namely, first of all, in the details, if you look, for example, for an average radius of this ring current, this is already different. But this is not so strong. What is really important is if you apply standard permanent magnetic fields, then usually the flux which is induced is about 1,000 times smaller than what you can achieve with this short laser pulse. So in this presentation that you have seen just before, the resulting flux is 84 microampere. And if you want to induce the same pulse by magnetic fields, you would need a magnetic field of 8,000 Tesla, which is not available. And so this is a new method using these short pulses to induce ring currents that you cannot achieve by any other technique. And okay, also these ring currents in turn will induce a magnetic field due to the ring current. So we use these ring currents to induce a magnetic field, and for example at the position of the metal, this is 0.1 Tesla, which is an effect of this laser pulse. Okay, and why is this difference? Well, in the magnetic field, okay, there's another huge difference, because in the magnetic field, you are just in the linear response domain, and that means you put your molecule and you get what you get. I mean, you cannot design the flux. But here, in our case, we can induce different excited states. We will also show that we can induce superposition states, and that gives us a tool of controlling the ring current. So the laser pulse can be interpreted as a traffic light, which will induce the flux of the electrons, for example, more along the inner rings than the outer rings, or vice versa, depending on the state. So we have a new tool for controlling electron flux, which is not available for magnetic fields. So it's much stronger, 1,000 times stronger. And why 1,000 times stronger? Well, essentially, you excite here more or less a full electron. So one electron in one orbital is more or less excited if you make a rough estimate, whereas here a 1/1000th of an electron is excited and is flowing. And this is a very weak effect in magnetic fields and very strong due to our ultra-short laser pulses. And also the helicity of the laser pulse is can be transferred to the electron density, and this will be shown now for the second application, when we do not prepare an eigenstate but we prepare a superposition state. So the goal is here to have a 50-50% superposition of the ground state and the target state, and then of course the result will not be stationary, but it will be time dependent. And here you see the simulation for this application. And in the beginning, it's very similar to what you have seen before. But now the pulse is shorter. It's only half duration as before. So we do not transfer 100%, but only 50%. And now you can see that really an electron is flowing. Okay, if you follow. And this is going on for some time before, of course, the time of the simulation of the model assumptions are good enough, and I come to this later. So here we really induce electron circulation, which okay, and this can be state selective.
Sorry, are the white atoms there hydrogens?
Pardon?
Are the white atoms hydrogens?
Yeah, these are hydrogens. These are carbons. This is a nitrogen. This is a metal.
So one would actually expect the hydrogens to be moving quite a lot on this time scale.
That's right. And so because a CH stretch, for example, is of the order of say 15 femtoseconds. So on this time scale, they should move already. And we have to worry about the effect of the nuclear motions. And indeed, this raises the question of what is the lifetime of these ring currents, and that will depend on the system. So we made some estimate exploratory quasi-classical simulations of this timescale, starting from the Franconian transition, and see what the nuclei do, and from this we can estimate that the lifetime of this is about 10 femtoseconds. So this is short,
but I putting young delicately.
It's related. There's something. Yeah. Not in this simulation. No. In this simulation, we really assume that the nuclei are fixed.
No, I meant young. This follow-up.
In this follow-up, it is the Jahn Teller effect, or in other language, we go to a conical intersection, and then from the excited state, we will go to the ground state, and so the lifetime of this is only, say, 10 femtoseconds. But these 10 femtoseconds would be enough to measure some effects of this ring current. I come to this later, because later I will show another example of another molecule where this lifetime of the ring current will be not a few 10 femtoseconds but nanoseconds. So this will depend very much on the system, and of course these are the first steps, and there are thousands and millions of molecules, and we can choose the proper one if you want to have a long ring current. Please.
Explain why the ring currents to an end at the end of the
pi pulse,
but
they
continue at the end of the pi
pulse. Yes. So in the first case, we prepare an eigenstate. So by definition, as the name says, we prepare an eigenstate, so then everything is stationary. But this eigenstate is a complex state. Think of a hydrogen atom. So you can excite one s orbital to say px or to py, and then you can build a superposition of these two states, and this can be called p plus or p minus, and this would correspond to a toroidal ring current, and then this represents a flux of electrons within this orbital. So this is stationary, this is stationary, this is also stationary, but this represents a flux. And likewise for our molecules, we have similar orbitals which can be superimposed by plus and minus complex combination, and then they correspond to these stationary ring currents.
On the other hand,
in the second example, we prepare, so to speak, a superposition of this plus this, and this is no longer an eigenstate, and that would really correspond to an electron which is moving around the molecule, so which could be observed as a moving object. But also it's related, but it's different.
Excuse me, what was the reason that the pulse length was a few femtoseconds and not, let's say, 1 femtosecond?
Well, if it's too short, then it's too broad. And then we no longer excite this eigenstate, but we would also excite simultaneously the neighboring states of the same symmetry. This can be an advantage if we want. If this can be exploited for tailoring the type of flux that we want.
Okay, to have two cycles of the wavelength.
That's for sure in these simulations. But if people want to make this electron ring currents, they can also apply longer pulses and apply a chirp, which will follow the nuclear dynamics of their different ways. We think that the use of the attosecond pulses is here to do it in the shortest time.
For example,
if the lifetime of the ring currents, as I said before, is only 10 femtoseconds, then you want to prepare it more rapidly than the lifetime of this pulse. And yes. Okay, now another simulation which will excite another state, and of course this is now state selective, and therefore you will see a different pattern of the electron circulation. So if you remember the previous movie and compare it with this one, then you will see that the ring current electron circulation is very different. Okay, you can try to follow electron, but now it's going via different bonds than shown before, and so this is really state selective. Again, it's something that we can do is using the laser pulses, but not using the magnetic fields. So we have a tool, and we can build superposition states of these excited states, and can really form our flux to our desire.
So the pi half pulse refers to a particular pair of states.
Yes. Right.
And so that's what you do, the pi half pulse, and the rest now follows by the...
Yes, right. And of course we can also combine a pulse and then another pulse, or we can excite superposition states using shorter pulses. So this is now a tool. We can really design the flux that we want in the molecule, preparing using different laser pulses.
So, but the trick then is to choose the particular pair of states on which you apply the pi half pulse.
Right now, yes, but this is not a limitation. And we can even choose superposition states of excited states. So we can make a linear superposition of excited states. This will also correspond to ring fluxes, but again, different ones. So we can use this for controlling the flux of molecules at our will.
Have you tried to get the electrons to move just along the protons?
Not yet. Good challenge. Good challenge, but we could, yes. Okay, so this shows the effect of pure pi pulse, pi half pulse from the three-state model, and what are the changes when we want to go to re-optimize pi half pulse. And you see that the duration is the same. This is now is with your courtesy. This is an attosecond pulse. It's a bit shorter than 1 femtosecond. And the field strengths are obviously changed a lot to re-optimize, and you see that without re-optimization we get about 40% of the superposition state, and here it's close to 50-50, so we can re-optimize. This is where we start and this is where we end up. And, okay, so the pi pulses are nevertheless quite helpful as a start. Okay, now I have to make a confession. Namely, in the previous applications we used the so-called, these famous sine squared pulses, but they violate a condition which is not important for long pulses, but which is very important for short pulses. And this was pointed out in particular in this reference. I mean, it's known to the experts anyway, but it was never really, people in our domain never paid attention to this. And so these pulses that you have seen before did not satisfy this condition. And in order to satisfy this condition, we follow the work of Bandrock and Tchaikovsky, and we start from the vector field and take the time derivative. And then, of course, this condition is fulfilled automatically, and we see what we get. And we are very glad that we get almost the same as before. So sine squared pulse was not a bad model. Another thing that I want to point out here, this is a nice, if not to say ingenious, invention by Ingo. So he studied starting empirically, he changed this exponent, and he saw that the shape of the laser pulse approaches a Gaussian. And of course we can put a Gaussian from the very beginning, But numerically, a Gaussian is from minus infinity to plus infinity, whereas if you use a cosine to the 20 pulse, then you have a finite duration, and it's better for the numerics. And this is a very simple relationship, and he's doing this together with Caroline Nasser, who's a mathematician, and she's completely excited about this empirical discovery of Ingo, and now they have a mathematical proof for this. And they, you know, in mathematics, there's a challenge to know the number pi in millions of units. And they think with this new theorem, they can go to from 1 million decimals to 2 million decimals. No, it's a limit. Yeah, it's a limit. So 20 goes to infinity, and 20 is good enough in practice. Already.
Cosine, when it's small, mm-hmm. that power of it should go to zero. So why cosine to the power of 20 doesn't go to zero very often?
Okay. I mean, at the same time, you stretch the total duration of the pulse. So you are right. If you start from a cosine pulse, which looks like so, and then you take a cosine to the fourth, then it would look like so. But then you spread the time of this pulse again, and then...
So this 20 should sit there somewhere in this...
In the duration. This duration is depending... Exactly. Right.
So pi must be...
This
by the 20.
Pp depends on this 20. Mm-hmm. So these are very useful if you want to simulate the Gaussians, and this is recommended. And now here's a comparison of the previous sine squared pulse and this, which fulfills the Bandrau condition, that we call it like so. And you see the pulses are quite, they change. So our previous attosecond pulse unfortunately blows up to 1.3 femtoseconds. And the pulses look very similar, but they are not the same anymore. But the effect of the pulses is almost the same as before. So we were worried whether these sine square pulses were giving misleading results, but I think this is a good confirmation. Okay, now we come to the second molecule, which is a very simple diatomic. So we come closer to physics. I was told that some physicists say two atoms is already too much, but this is two atoms, and it's the same game. So here we choose degenerate states, either pi states or delta states, and they are very nicely separated from each other. And Ingo chose one state which has the property that if you go from the ground state, then the minimum of the excited state is almost on top of each other. That's how he chooses from many molecules. And that means if you excite this, then you will not excite any nuclear dynamics for even a nanosecond. So the excited state nuclear wave packet won't move, and therefore, and it's also very, very far away from any other state. So the next one is here, the lower state will be here. And so this is very isolated, and it's a vertical transition, a van Condon type transition, so no nuclear motions, and this is chosen to have a long-lived electronic excited state. And very well chosen from many, not so many molecules who are so kind, but this one is. And then again, here's the laser pulse, and here's the population of a single excited state. And this now will correspond to toroidal ring currents, which I want to show in a movie. And here you see two different projections. This is looking from the side, and this is from the top. And this is what the electron sees as the laser pulse propagates along the field. And you see the electron is, of course, circulating initially, but if you prepare an eigenstate, then at the very end, you prepare a stationary state. And within this tori, you have circulating fluxes, electronic fluxes. And now let's compare the corresponding ring currents. So before we have seen this large molecule, And now we have the small molecule, this is the axis, and this is a cut through the electron flux. It's not the density, it's the flux. And we have this electrons going around here, or going around here. And now the challenge is, what do you think, how will the fluxes compare for the large molecule and for the small molecule? What would you guess? Which one produces the better fluxes? And so, just do you have
larger?
Yeah, which molecule can be used for making stronger fluxes?
Sorry, your formula says the R must be small.
You look already at the formula. Okay. Yeah, so you know the answer. So intuitively one might be misled. One could say, well, big molecule, big flux, but it's really the other way around, because the flux is calculated from this Biot-Savart formula, and if you make an approximation, it's very roughly the current divided by the mean, it's really this here, the mean inverse density. And this is of course very large here, and this is very small here, and therefore, and also I will show that the flux is larger here compared to here. This can also be understood, and therefore the effects are much smaller and are much larger in the smaller system. And so here's the answer. Previously we induce a magnetic field here, which was already 0.16 tesla due to the ring current. If we go to the diatomic, we induce a huge magnetic field. I mean, you need a big machine to achieve this machine. That's what the nuclei see when you switch this on by this short laser pulse. And why is this so? You have seen the formula before. So here the distance is about 6 atomic units. Here it's much, much smaller, 0.1. And also the ring current here is much smaller than here. So there's another effect which contributes to this much larger magnetic field.
And I can understand why the field
works.
This was the first question. And then the second question is the consequence is also the...
The flux will have an R squared times it, so the larger molecule would win.
Yes, and now I have to explain why this is not true. Why? Because you see, this is about 6 times, so almost an order of magnitude larger. And why is this? I will explain this. So this is this first thing I should, well, this is one thing that is pretty obvious, right? Because this has a huge diameter, and this is very small, so everybody can understand this. But why this? Why is the flux almost an order of magnitude bigger than in the small molecule compared to the large molecule? And this can be explained as follows. So when you excite the system, that was the previous question, how many photons are transferred. Well, ultimately you transfer one photon. And you can do this by many processes or by a single process, but you transfer one photon if you go from one state to this next one. And for the small molecule, this is really one H bar, this one here. For the electrons, whereas in this molecule we have to share the transfer of angular momentum between the electrons and the nuclei. So at the same time when you switch on the electrons, also the nuclei will start to move. There's certain pseudo-rotations which are induced. So therefore this flux doesn't correspond to h-bar, but it's really about 2.5 h-bar. It's a little larger. But what is important is it's the same order of magnitude. So we know how much angular momentum is in this electron flux. It's typically of the order of h bar, or a little larger, depending on how you share this between electrons and nuclei. And now this is a very simple relationship. So the angular momentum can be estimated as the frequency times the moment of inertia. And the frequency is, of course, the inverse time of rotating this electron flux. And time can be expressed using the flux, the electron flux. This is just electron charge or charge per time. And therefore, you get this simple relationship for the flux. Now, this angular momentum is of the same order of magnitude, but again, the radius appears here even with the square. And that is the reason why the flux is also much larger for the smaller molecule compared to the big molecule. And this estimate is even almost quantitative. And we can also calculate individual fluxes of this lobe of the flux around the aluminium compared to the chlorine. And then we get a sharing, you can already see this here for the aluminium, it's much bigger. It's roughly a ratio 3-1, how this flux is shared between the corresponding atoms. And from this, we can also estimate the magnetic fields which are induced at the nuclei, and this is now the magnetic field along this axis, and you see that close to the to atoms we have these huge magnetic fields which are so easily induced using these short laser pulses and which would require big machines to do this by magnetic fields. Okay, so we can understand this ratio simply by knowing the fluxes and by knowing the inverse, we can understand everything within 3-5.
Tesla is 10⁴ Gauss.
Yes, I think so.
The record in the IQ is 10⁶ Gauss, pulsed magnetic fields.
Yeah, if you have pulsed, they can be larger. Yes. But you need.
Some Tesla, I think, you can get 1,000 Tesla.
Yeah. But here you would need 8,000 to have the same effect. So I think the attosecond pulses or short pulses should do a very good job here. Yeah. But these magnetic pulses, as far as I know, are also much longer. They are on the picosecond time scale and did not yet reach the femtosecond time scale. Yeah, sure, yes, you can, yeah. Yes, the rule is the smaller the better. So we are doing this now for the hydrogen atom. It's the simplest system. And. I tell you during this workshop, okay? We are doing this during this workshop. Okay. This was a discussion of Ingo and myself yesterday night. No, I never work on Sunday, but on Saturday night and continued this morning. So we will also go for hydrogen. You can write this for Ingo because, okay. So during this workshop, we promise a number. Okay, we have 2 weeks. Should be enough. We can.
We can do that easily for Rydberg atom.
Yeah. Then you have many more angular momenta. It can be much higher. You can have, but you also have very big radius. So one has to see the two competing effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rydberg, I mean, you can make classical calculations.
Yes.
And then simply scale with M to get the estimate of the mm-hmm. one.
Good suggestion. Very, very stimulating. So now we come to the conclusions for this part. So we have shown that we can induce periodic electron circulation and the helicity of the laser field will be induced to corresponding the helical motion of the electrons. One circulation is of the order of 1 femtosecond. And for the electronic ring currents, the summary is, in comparison with the traditional magnetic fields, we are 1,000 times stronger and we can also control the kind of flux. The method so far has been ultra simple, so we just use ordinary quantum chemistry and apply this very simple propagation of the coefficients. And you pointed just now to this analogy of the Rydberg state, so there are indeed beautiful analogies with Kepler orbits, but these are on the microsecond or picosecond time scale. And well, for the control of electron transfer, I want to give credit to the late Kent Wilson and his group, who in 1997 suggested that one should use pi pulses to induce electron transfer. At that time, he couldn't do this, and he even didn't know that such laser pulses would be available today, but he had a big vision in this paper. And I also want to recommend very strongly the work of Peter Saalfrank and Tilman Klamroth. They have a series of publications now, and I want also to point to some experience that we have in our group for using circularly polarized pulses for different purposes for enantiomer selectivity. And then I always get the question at the end of the pulse, how do you see this, and how can you verify experimentally that you really have these electron ring currents? And this could be done using high harmonic generation. The beautiful work by the group of Alon and Cederbaum and family, who have shown that if you have a certain cylindrical or other symmetry, then there are specific beautiful selection rules for the harmonic generation. They indeed use it for taking a cigar of C, not C60, but C1000, and then they could show that you can prepare a single, say the hundredths high harmonic selectively compared to the others. And these selection rules would also apply here, so the patterns of the high harmonics would look very different from non-ring current. One could use photoelectron spectroscopy. One can also look for the effects of these induced magnetic fields. Now I want to come briefly to our second topic. Namely, everything you have seen so far was very simple because we would just make bound state to bound state transitions, even though this is interesting phenomena which can be studied. But the challenge for the methods, of course, what to do if you have ionization. And unfortunately, then we cannot use standard quantum chemistry because Gaussian or whatever package doesn't have ionization. In the continuum. And so the solutions that I could think of is discretization of the continuum or using time-dependent orbitals. And we go for the second choice, and Ingo has designed a hierarchy of methods starting from explicit, I show what this means in a minute, single active electron field to double and then to multi. And this is something which is a very simple approximation to the work that other people do, like Peter Saalfrank or Dr. Skrinsky would do. So they do this much, much better. This is a simple approximation, but still we can learn a lot from this. So we have chosen hydrogen as to start, and we assume that I will show why. We assume that the hydrogen has been pre-excited to this state. Remember, those of you who were here last week, when Professor Gross was presenting density functional applications, he could not use his technique to prepare the system, but of course it can be prepared, and we assume that this has been prepared. And then we will assume that starting from this excited state, we go to ionization. And we do this in a single active state. So we assume that this orbital is frozen, and the other one will be time dependent. So the initial condition is that this is this 1 sigma u orbital. And this is a pictorial graphic. So we would start from the ground state. The ground state can be written as a superposition of these orbitals. This can be a key helping Professor Gross perhaps. Yeah, you can write this as this, and then you allow that spin-up orbital is time-dependent, whereas the other is frozen, and vice versa. Then you can prepare the state, and then you can excite even higher. And this corresponds a little bit to a time-dependent Koopmans picture. So in quantum chemistry, people like Koopman's picture. That means all orbitals are frozen except, say, the HOMO, which is excited to the LUMO. And this is very familiar in time-independent quantum chemistry. And this is a picture transferring this Koopman's view to the time-dependent domain. Of course, it's only an approximation, because we assume that the other orbitals are frozen. And here, if you insert this ansatz into the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, then that's the set of equations that you get for the time-dependent orbital. And we make a point here of explicit single-active electron model, because until now, to the best of our knowledge, people have always treated, say, the time-dependent orbital in a kind of effective field of the other orbitals, but they never did it explicitly. What we want to do here is really treat all the other orbitals, and that's what you get for the simple system for H2, and we go also to larger molecules, and then this equation for the time-dependent orbital is a little bit more involved, because you have, so this is a complete set of equations that you have to solve if you really do the single active electron model explicitly. This has never been done before, and I think it should still be investigated and to see what how good it is without doing approximations of effective fields. Now, this is to explain why we choose this pre-excitation. So we want to, in the beginning, not to have complications of nuclear motions. And therefore, Ingo has chosen a transition from this excited state to the ground state of the H2 plus of the ion. And you see the minima are pretty close. Therefore, if we induce this transition, we have good reasons to expect that there will be rather little nuclear motion that will perturb our results. If, on the other hand, we would start from the ground state, go up here, then of course we have huge nuclear motions which have been measured and described also by Bandrock and other people. There's a very nice experiment by Wacking which shows that the nuclear motion starts to move already within 5 femtoseconds. But for this transition, we can start from the approximation that the nuclear will not move. It's almost vertical. And moreover, we have calculated we have tested the assumption of frozen orbitals. And if you take the frozen orbital for the ground state and for this excited state, then we see that it is close to, the overlap is almost one. So that shows that it will not change, and we can have a good assumption that this is really frozen. Moreover, if we do CI expansion of the excited states here, then this single Slater determinant contributes 99.4%, so it's almost a pure Hartree-Fock state, so this is also a very favorable state. Now, for this system, we now solve the equation that you have seen before, and we do it first for a weak field. Now, weak here means close to 10 to the 15 watts per square centimeters, because we are interested in seeing ionization. And this diagram shows the electric field, so the duration is 1 femtosecond, the total duration is 3 femtoseconds, but the mean duration is 1 femtosecond. And as a consequence of this field, we will see that the dipole will change, and that the probability of remaining in the original molecule decreases, of course. And we will also see that we see some flux for ionization. This is very weak for this intensity, but there is some flux already. We will also see that the energy changes, but here the changes are very little. So I show these results only for reference. Here you can see the ionization is very weak and the change in energy is very weak. Later we go to strong fields and you will see much more drastic effects. So we will show... now I'm lost without Ingo. Oh, good. I would be lost without him, but he's also lost without me, so we are really a tandem. So what you see here is the electric field, and you see snapshots along the electric field. This is how the dipole will change. It will follow more or less the electric field. And what you see here is the time evolution of the wave packet. And this is a blow up of what happens close to this. So what you see here is the original sigma ungerade orbital, and then the laser, this weak laser, weak laser field is shining, and you see here the autocorrelation function of how much is still in the original orbital decreases. And I want to draw your attention to the patterns that you see here. So there are lobes of the wave function which are shaken away to this direction and to the other direction. And we think that this phenomena are quite different from the simple Korkum's view of electron which will be kicked off, ionized, and then come back or so. And he assumes always a nice Gaussian wave packet which will recollide, but if you do the real simulation, then it's not like so. And okay, now we come to the strong field, and this is now 3 to the 10 to the 15 watts per square centimeters. Here's the laser pulse, here's the effect of the dipole. This is how the autocorrelation function decays. Here you have a lot of, substantial ionization, and also the energy really goes from the excited hydrogen to the ion. And oh, I apologize. Because we convince ourselves before that this is a vertical transition from a minimum to another minimum, which is directly vertically on top. You could not see this. So this transition is to a situation where you go almost from one minimum to the other one. And then, of course, the nuclei will not start to move. That's how we choose this this condition.
What you call explicit
CMX. Yes.
We keep all the orbital states except one or
right.
More.
Right. Yeah. And we keep it explicitly in the equations of motion. So in all the approaches that we know, this was not done. They, at some stage, they do an approximation for an effective field.
I think there are these approaches for core electrons. They go with core electrons and then you don't build the potential of them. They build up core electrons.
That's another step. But here we keep all the orbitals but frozen and explicitly. So you think this has not been done before? Okay. Now, I would call this a violent pulse because it really destroys the topology of the orbital. You see these wild patterns; they cannot be described by Gaussian Now I must confess that these results that you see here are not yet converged. We're still fighting with some numerical problems, but we think they can be overcome.
Your field is parallel to the molecule.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Only we know harmonics, that's very common. Because we have spent this Ugarada, if
field was perpendicular, it's not harmonic, it's not an egg, yes. Yeah, but it's along the axis. Yeah. But I would like to discuss some more details with you and learn from you. But okay, so I think this is more or less what I wanted to tell. And okay, this is just showing a view to the future. So from this ansatz, a single electron, Ingo can go to two time-dependent orbitals. And for example, we can do something similar, what is known in quantum chemistry as a complete active space, and we put the time-dependent ones in this active space, and the other ones will be frozen. And of course, this is not so good as if you do the time-dependent MCTDH approach or something equivalent, which is designed by the Skrinsky group or by the Zalfang group. But if you want to do models, then I think this can be a good approach. Okay, so with this I want to close and thank the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft for support, and also thank again the organizers here for the really very lovely and exciting atmosphere, which I could also see from the feedback of many questions. And finally, I want to show those who cannot be here at the time. This is my work group in Berlin right now, and this is Leticia Gonzalez, who participates in the H2 project, and this is Gennady Paramonov, who also participates in this project. And these are two student helpers who helped to prepare the movies for the H2. The other movies were done by Ingo himself. So this is I want to finish. Thank you.
This 20 states calculation, you found a package to provide you transition electrons. I always say significantly, even for H2, only one or few transition electrons.
Yeah.
Yeah, suppose you recalculate everything, that you recalculate the wave function and just integrate it numerically.
Well, the transition moments are taken from quantum chemistry.
They did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this we took from the literature, actually. So.
Yeah, I always say for any molecules I can typically even for H2, and then we know only few conditions.
Yeah, we contacted
Volnevich.
Not
all that long ago,
he has maybe 100 of them, but all of them are missing. So five
other
transitions.
Yeah. Not
some,
very few.
Yeah.
You
no, we didn't do this ourselves. We took it from the literature. So, because these are so famous molecules, this has been treated by. And of course, it's only approximate. What Volnevich does for H2 cannot compete with the results for.
So you apply to this, only to
depend on
frequency. So you have frequency flow to one photon transition resonance, so that's why this process predominates. So it always works.
Right.
But once you are apart from any one photon resonance, but in the 20 state case, you are not using protons.
No. But I had shown this one transparency for this comparison of the three-state versus multi-state model, and you have seen that the pulses still had to be retuned quite a bit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is that correct that your calculations are meaningful when these fields, the pulses, are not too intense?
Yes.
Because otherwise you have
yes.
to take many, many, many more states.
Yeah,
of
right. Right, yeah.
So,
right.
So these last calculations that you said you numerically have, don't have convergence yet or something like that, belongs to this class that actually cannot solve.
Yes, I mean this H2 example really produces ionization, and you cannot describe this using bound states. It's not possible. So therefore, we have to go beyond, and this cannot be. The quantum chemistry packages are not good for this H2. It's
you're using different methods.
Yes. Yeah.
So this H2 calculation was still done at the independent electron level, right? With single Slater determinant. But you mentioned something about going to a bond length of 2.4, which is a pretty large, this is atomic units, yes? Or
yes, I think it's atomic units, yeah.
Because, I mean, there's this known problem that a single Slater determinant cannot describe the dissociation of an H2 molecule on. I wonder where this okay. begins to become a fundamental problem.
Okay, this here's the answer. So again, if you want to describe the photoionization starting from the ground state, and you make a vertical transition to the lowest ion, then you end up somewhere here. And then this has nuclear motions, and this cannot be described using a fixed nuclei. But we choose specifically this transition, which is much kinder to us.
Well, I don't have a problem with choosing that, but I guess I'm questioning whether the wave function is starting to deteriorate so far beyond the one electron model that
Well, I think okay. I think the assumption of a one electron model for this transition are really very good, because if you take the sigma grad, I mean, this state is described by 99% by a single Slater determinant, symmetry adapted, at this specific nuclear distance. This depends on the nuclear distance, but for this specific distance, it's 99%. So the single Slater determinant is a very good model here. Okay, this is the first. And then you want to compare, well, if I kick off this sigma ungerade, then I'm left with H2+. I'm left with the ion. And then we compare this one sigma grade for the H2 with the one sigma grade for the H2+, and the overlap is close to one. So that
so the X state plays no role in this whatsoever. You
no.
you assume something
X state,
else excited you.
Right.
Okay, I didn't catch that. Mm. I see. Mm.
And so going back to the first part on this electron currents.
Right.
The main application you suggested was to harmonic generation of new molecules.
That could be well, we didn't do high harmonic generation so far, but I mean that's something that could be used, for example, for the diagnostics, or it can also be applied as a tool. Because if you have these ring currents, then the high harmonic generation spectra are predicted to be very different from the usual ones. So usually you have this decay, then you have the plateau, and then you have the fall-off regime. Now, if you have a circular polarized electron circulation in the system, then it's not like this. You have specific spikes or peaks which kick off for certain harmonics. For example, for Alon et al., they could show that only the 100th harmonic will kick out for a large molecule. And here the patterns are really different. So if you want to prepare only one, then this can be a good method.
Well, earlier question,
just now we discussed in addition linear polarization, light generates harmonics superposed on your circuit. That's how. That's all you meant. One linear plant superposed on. Because
circular itself
doesn't generate harmonics.
That's right, yeah. But after the excitation, then you can. Yeah. And in order to measure this effect, harmonic generation takes 1-2 femtoseconds or less. So if this ring current lives for 3 femtoseconds, it's long enough. You can see it. And you can use it if you want to make special harmonics selectively.
The other application might be using the magnetic resonance, which is fundamental to chemistry.
Yes.
You can create very
harmonic. Yeah. You have this in mind. At the beginning, I mentioned that this molecule has application in photodynamic therapy. There they have to know where is this molecule, where is it in your body. If you have cancer or so, then they attach this molecule to the cancer cells selectively. Then they shine light, and then this induces cell demolation at the order at the space where you have these molecules. So you want to know where are these molecules. And this could be done using NMR, for example. You can influence the signals to NMR using this method here. But this is very speculative. Just maybe there is some application in medicine at some stage.
Every day at